Thank you very kindly. We have an interesting subject today, which has not received the attention that would be appropriate in the past, because things that are close at hand are not generally considered as deeply as matters of a far distant location. The American Indian is right here, and we have taken him for granted for a long time, and it is only in the last 20, 25 years that research concerning this great culture group has received a great deal of attention. First of all, let's bear in mind that it is obvious that the American Indian did not originate here. And where he came from has become a source of great deal of research in recent times. Some believe that he is an Asiatic who came here by way of the Bering Straits migration or the Aleutian Island chain. Others believe that he came directly across from the Orient. The Chinese have records of exploration on this continent, and ancient Chinese artifacts have been found underground and excavated in the area of Mexico City. Also, there is considerable thought that perhaps the Japanese had something to do with this, because they have records of an extensive exploration from what we would term Baja California all the way down to Peru. And in order that it might not be assumed that they have taken this matter lightly, the Japanese government presented to the government of Peru a statue of the first traditional emperor of Japan to bear witness to the fact that the early Japanese explorers did actually reach Peru. There are also other sides to this. We have the Atlantic side. Here we have a very large dissemination and distribution. The Seminoles in the Florida area have very clear record that they came from a land to the east, that they came across what was then a land bridge, which later disappeared. These people may have come from some of the Near Eastern or North African stock, such as the Egyptians. Then there are many records and reports concerning the explorations of the Norse people, the Vikings at the north, who certainly came over to this continent. Plutarch, in his study of the voyages of the ancient Greeks, measured carefully the time and distance symbols of Greek chronology and decided that there was no doubt that navigation from Greece did reach the actual continent of America at a comparatively early date. Plato, of course, in his discussion of the submergence of Atlantis, points out, as he says, that after that continent was destroyed, navigation to the west ceased. If it ceased, it might well have existed before that, or records or traditions as brought by Solon from Egypt would indicate that there was definite exploration and colonization in the Western Hemisphere. We know that the Chaldeans and Phoenicians traded copper and metals with the peoples of Western Europe and the British Isles. There is no doubt that they could have made a similar passing over to the Western Hemisphere. We know that the idea that it was an unknown area, completely forgotten or ignored, up to the time of Columbus, simply is not true. In fact, if you may have seen the recent film on Columbus, there are a few fragments of it that are authentic, not all, however. But one of the points that I think is interesting is to realize that actually Columbus was impelled or inspired to his voyage, not by the friendliness of the European powers, but by the fact that he was trying to demonstrate and prove the lost continent theory of Plato. It's now rather well guessed and probably true that Christopher Columbus, of whom no likeness is known to have survived, was actually a Greek navigator by the name of Nypsilantes, that he traveled on ships following Greek traditions, according to the records of Plutarch and Plato, that he found a Western world There can be no doubt. But, of course, his landfall never reached the actual continent of America. Actually, also, other explorations and other types of study have brought in all kinds of modifying opinions about the American Indian group. We divide that group largely into the North American, Central American, and South American cultures. Because of the availability of certain records and the limitation of time, we have to summarize some of this material in rather briefly to arrive at our principal subject. In the first place, there is much evidence that the cosmogony of the North American Indian group, and for that matter, the Central American, this cosmogony is almost exactly Phoenician. In other words, it has to do with the divisions of the universe, as these divisions were recognized in Europe and Asia very much earlier than any exploration in the Western Hemisphere. The universe of the American Indian was divided roughly into three sections, or three parts. We have to also remember that we are dealing with a polyglot group of tribes, each one with a little different tradition, each one more or less specialized and isolated by their way of life. But at the same time, generally speaking, we find the triple phase of universal structure present in nearly all of the groups, as is pointed out very clearly by Schoolcraft, who is the principal earlier authority on the American Indians in the United States area. The three parts of the universe of the Phoenicians and later of the Indians were, or rather consisted, of the three divisions of the world. The first and highest division was heaven. Heaven was a vast expanse. Heaven was the abode of the primordial powers, the forces, the principles, from which all other things descended. The second division was the earth, in which the peoples created by the various deities lived out their destinies. And the third division was the underworld. The underworld was not regarded as a purgatorial region, but a dark earth from which all mortal things grew or came forth. In the Southwest Indians, a deluge myth exists, and the chosen tribes were saved by coming up from the underworld on the stalks of corn. They therefore came, and most mortals were believed to have come from the underworld. This is almost completely Greek and Egyptian, because it is assumed definitely in all classical systems that the material or objective structures of things came out of the earth and were met in a middle distance by the powers of deity descending, and the union of heaven and earth produced man. This is the simple statement of it. Of course, it is much more complicated. But in this respect, it was assumed that the three parts of the world were the same in principle as those set forth by Ptolemy of Alexandria, by the Brahmins, by the Lamas of Tibet, by the Buddhists, by the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Persians, and the early Semites. They all had the same basic pattern. Now, the question naturally arises, was this pattern transferred from one area to another by travel, migration, exploration, or missionary activity? Or did these divisions arise from the natural internal consciousness of the person or the being itself? This probably cannot be completely solved, but the general trend today is to assume definitely that there was a contact between the Western Hemisphere and the sources of European, Near Eastern, and Asiatic cultures. These points are practically all demonstrated firmly in the records that have since come into existence and which are now being studied. Now, if this is the way it goes in general, then we have to consider how a religion develops within a tribal structure. Here we have, for the most part, except in the Southwest area, migrant peoples, tribes and groups that travel about over a vast area comparatively uninhabited. These groups were isolated into brood families. They were small cultural entities, 10 families, 50 families, 100 families. But they were worlds to themselves, and their entire existence was largely within the small local atmosphere of their own brood group. Now, over the brood group in the Indian philosophy of life, there was always the brood mother, and the descent was very largely on the mother's side, which follows almost precisely the teachings of Egypt. In Egypt, the descent of families was measured by the mother's family, and the royal of the line of Egypt descended on the mother's side. So in the brood family, for some unknown reason, they used the same concept as brought the pharaohs of Egypt to their thrones. And yet these were little groups of people wandering around with no real language in common, but bound together by the needs, tribulations, and problems of survival. So we have here the beginning of a tribal life, the tribe being composed of the children of one descent. Therefore, the government was parental. It was neither the government of the father nor of the mother, but of the family. And the tribe was a family. It did not consist of a series of individuals, each working out his own destiny as he saw fit. Everyone was related to everyone else, if not physically, at least psychologically. Now, in the Pueblos of the Southwest, of course, it became obvious that this parental concept, the one brood family, could result in difficulties, particularly genetic difficulties. Therefore, among the Pueblo peoples, there was always a division. There were always two houses and two parts to the brood family. Both parts were ruled by women, but the two family groups married across the Pueblo. Everyone had to marry a person from the opposite Pueblo. Now, how did they come to this particular conclusion, we do not know, but it is part of the ancient tradition that came down to them from the olds, from the wise ones, from the good, from the great that had gone before. Because they had no written language, it was inevitable that the Indian would develop the storyteller, the wise man, the sage, the sachem. They were all people who carried forward the tradition by word of mouth. Every young person growing up in an Indian tribe was instructed in the orenda of his people. Orenda was the atmosphere, the psychological realities of things. The tribe was held together not by birth primarily, nor by location, nor by mutual struggle for survival. They were all factors. But the principal factor was the orenda. And the orenda is a term we have finally gotten into the English language, but it had to come through the German before it got here. The orenda is actually the mysterious power of the story, the tradition. It was the telling of the glories of the past. It was a way of stimulating in each young person a respect for that which had gone before, and a determination to live up to the standards of integrities that came down from the ancestors. Now, this concept of orenda could be traceable to China, where the same concept was very strong, that each individual was responsible for preserving the reputation of his ancestors. This came, in some cases, to ancestor worship, and there were traces even of this in some of the tribal rites and ceremonies. But in any event, the orenda was to make you proud of the fact that you belonged to your tribe, that you had job and duty to perform, that it was your need and proper right that under all conditions you would sacrifice yourself for the common good. Each individual was therefore a defender of his people. And in this sense, the tribes developed a certain survival pattern that was useful and helpful. So the old taught the new. The old gave to the young the story of the people, and also the story of the dreams of the people, the hopes, the aspirations. It was also natural, of course, to follow in this situation the policies of the other continents. And one of the great policies of migration and migrant peoples was the policy of the masters of the journey. When a caravan left Egypt for the central part of Africa, or when one in the Near East traveled on from Damascus to Antioch, a caravan was a unit of people. A mobile Indian tribe was also a caravan, always on the way. The Plains Indians had to travel to maintain the source of resource. They had no agriculture to speak of, and they were constantly in search of new ground to leave behind the waste and trash of previous residences. So the three parts of the tribe, they're very interesting. It is stated in the Bible that when Solomon was to build a temple, he sent to his friend Hiram of Tyre, another king, to join with him. And together they produced or brought together a group of workmen under the leadership of a master artificer. And the great temple was built by these three men working together: Solomon the king, Hiram the king, and Chiram the great artificer. Now, in the caravan, as it goes today across the wastes of Asia, the moment a caravan is organized, it becomes mandatory to elect the officers that are to rule the caravan, because caravans could be attacked by terrible storms, they could be attacked by wicked brigands, they could come into many kinds of evil. And it was necessary for the caravan to have a fully organized structure even before it set out. Maybe there would be 50 or 100 camels or more, but they had to be an organization to carry on the caravan. So they elected the master of the caravan, who was the final voice in all things relating to the journey. They also elected the master of the march, who had to do with the protection of the caravan from the dangers and terrors of the way. And the third officer was the master of rest and repose. He was the one that chose the campsite, made arrangements for water and food, and did everything that was necessary to protect the caravan through the hours of darkness. These were the three officers that had charge of this important phase of existence. Now, among the Sioux people and among most of the American Indian tribes, every tribe had these three leaders that were appointed, that carried on the work of the people, maintained the tribe in its function, and probably the most famous of these was the Sioux triad, consisting of Chief Gall, Crazy Horse, and Sitting Bull. That particular tribe, the tribe that finally was the undoing of General Custer, that tribe had first the leader of the whole tribe. He was the one who corresponded to King Solomon. Then with him was the master of the march. This was Crazy Horse, the war chief. And the third was the counselor, spiritual head, who reigned or ruled while the caravan was at peace, or where the tribe had no outside problems, who was the keeper of the culture and the religion of the people. And this was Sitting Bull. Now, how was a person like Sitting Bull appointed? No one knows just exactly, but from the tribal reports, we believe that the medicine priests or the medicine chiefs or the chiefs of repose and rest were born, not made. Every Indian in a tribe was considered with equal care. To find out which one was obviously and strangely a mystic, who possessed some mysterious power that the Orenda had descended upon this person. And very often, every Indian had to do his vigil. And very often, the Indian who did his vigil had the vision of the Thunderbird. And if he had the vision of the Thunderbird, he was a medicine priest. The Thunderbird of the Indian is the phoenix of the rest of the world. Same principles, same concepts, same ideal. And the phoenix in case, in substance, was the symbol of the spiritual government of the group, the race, the nation, or the tribe. Also a very interesting point is, in the American Indian, that Sitting Bull and all the medicine priests dressed differently from the other members of the tribe. Every one of the medicine priests wore a costume combining male and female attributes, that they had to be distinguished so that, in a sense, they were represented as androgynous beings. We realize, of course, that for ages, the clergies of nearly all religions have worn robes that were not the same as the secular garments of their people. These robes, with their skirts and flaring headpieces and so forth, were the symbols of the mystical level of humanity, the level in which the heart and the mind, the female and the male, were united in eternal union, producing the mystic with his extrasensory perceptions. Now, in the American Indian tribe, there was another point involved in this that was interesting. The Indians, unfortunately, were frequently troubled with the inter-tribal warfare and so forth, and the medicine priests were never in the battle. They remained aloof. And neither side was permitted to injure one of the priests. His garments revealed his station, and he was therefore regarded as equally sacred by two tribes in deadly enmity with each other on every other subject. This was an interesting aspect of religion, which meant a great deal, apparently, to these people. The same concept also survives in Egypt for a long, long time. Having attained the rulership of the tribe, then the problem of the education of the mystic was very important. Now, we know that the traditions of initiation into various rites are common throughout the Near East, the Far East, and North Africa. We also realize that these initiation rites have descended from a remote antiquity. The American Indian had them also. His initiation rites differed with various tribes, but probably the most interesting that we have, carefully preserved by the reports of the Smithsonian Institution, is the mystery ritual of the Midi, a tribe that had a very highly evolved ritualism, which has been compared and was compared in the Smithsonian reports with the accounts of ancient mystery rituals and modern masonry. The Midi initiation was divided into three degrees, presented in a structure with three rooms, representing, as we have noted, the three parts of the universe. Those seeking to become aware of the secrets of the tribe went through various tests and initiations and obligations and were tried in every way before they were given the leadership of the family of tribes to which they belonged. The Midi rituals were kept on a birch bark board or trestle board, and several of these trestle boards are in existence, and we have one in our library collection here. These boards represent the rooms in which the rites were given. One room was behind the other. There is a similar structure, almost identical, in the Hawaiian Islands, except that the three rooms are one above another instead of one in front and the others behind it. So all over, these things were commonly held, and they are very important to our thinking. If, for instance, a young person is born into the tribe as a mystic to become a medicine priest, Of course, he must first do vigil. He must go forth and find his place in the larger universe. The Indian realized very much what we know now as a mysticism or a psychism. He went forth alone. He fasted as the prophets of old. He smoked the sachem. He smoked the pipe of the sachem, which was the same as the burning altar of Jerusalem. He put his prayer flags on this ground, as the Tibetans do, and he put on these little sticks, the feathers, which were the symbol of the creation of a square lodge or a room, and he sat in the midst of it and prayed and meditated and asked for help to call upon the old and the true and the wise, the ones from the great medicine lodge in the sky who were to come down and tell him what to do and how to live, and create with him a contact by which he could ask for their help whenever it was necessary. This ritual system went on until testing, proving, and initiating were confirmed by the tribe as having been successfully experienced by the novice. He was then given the position of a tribal teacher. I asked one of them once how he gained his knowledge of healing. For healing was perhaps the most important of all the mystery rites of the American Indians. And he said very simply that he had never been instructed by anyone. The previous medicine priests had not conveyed any information to him. Each one had to find his way of healing for himself. He had to go out and ask. And when sickness came, he had to watch for the omens, watch for the signs, watch for the indications by which the great ones would show him the remedy for the illness at hand. And it usually so occurred. In one case that came to my attention, the priest went out to pray in the darkness of the night, and in the midst of his prayers, he saw a little spark of light shining at him out of the darkness. And he went over, and it was a little plant growing in the ground, and it had a spark of light had centered in it. And he took that plant, made out of that the herbal tea that brought about the recovery of the patient. The Indian depended on these signs all the time. He depended upon all of the atmosphere around him, all of the air. To him, the world was filled with life and light. Every bit of air was a potential carrier of truths, of wisdoms, of mysteries and marvels. The Indians also, like most other peoples, had a world of elementary beings. They had their gnomes and their sylphs and their undines. They had the nature spirits. Among the nature spirits were the water Indians, who came on to the land only on rare intervals, and the cave Indians, who came out only at night. And Longfellow in his Hiawatha describes a number of these elementary forms that were believed in by the Indians and which appeared to them in dreams and visions. Now, the Indian was not essentially a cruel person, but he was confronted with a situation that was very difficult for him to solve. He had to feed his people. He had no agriculture as we know it. Most of his land would not support a great abundance of natural foods. He had to therefore hunt. He had to go out and follow the buffalo herds and gain the food for his people. But the Indian was not a sportsman. He never killed for sport. He never killed to prove that he could. And he took a very deep and mystical and mysterious attitude in connection with hunting for food. When he found that it was necessary for him to kill a buffalo to feed his people, he would sit down very quietly by the side of the slain animal and bring out his pipe of peace and bring out the symbols of meditation and prayer, and he would thank the spirit of that animal. He would explain to that animal that it knew as well as he knew that the people were hungry, that he had not killed for sport, nor had he killed because he disliked the buffalo. He killed because his children had to have food. Now, this sounds somewhat as an appeasement, but there is a second line to it that is much more interesting. Because the Indians had a belief that every so many thousands of years, animals and humans exchanged places. And that in some time, in the infinite future, it would happen that he, as the hunter, would be in turn the hunted. So he said to the spirit of the buffalo, "When the time comes and I am a buffalo, and you are a man, I will give my body as you have given yours." This was a religious conviction, and was one of the strange and rather interesting details of Indian thought and life. Now, the Indians also were very much given to solving problems simply and efficiently. They had very simple tribal laws, but in many cases their laws were exceedingly wise. If in a tribe of where Sitting Bull was the medicine priest and the mystical counselor and the paterfamilias of all of these Indians, two young braves got into a quarrel. It was a bitter quarrel, and there was bad word and threat of violence. But no one could go against the medicine priest. So the medicine priest stepped in between them. They didn't dare say anything to him. And he said, "Dig a hole." So the two did as they were told. They dug a hole about 4 feet deep in the earth. And he then turned to one and says, "Say your hate into the hole." And he said to the other, "Say your hate into the hole. Now cover it up and shake hands." That was the solution to a delicate problem. And also Sitting Bull was responsible for certain laws concerning the treatment of people. If, as was sometimes the case, the hunting was difficult, and food was not too abundant, even from the herds that were still undecimated, the Indian finally came back with a kill, or food, or whatever he could bring. Immediately, the medicine priest took over. In fact, he didn't have to after the first time, because it became automatic. He said, "You have food. All right. You must not say who you are or what you bring, but each of you in secret will take a piece of that food and place it at the entrance to the wigwam of every widow and every child. They eat first. If there's not enough, the brave man does not eat at all. If there is enough, the old and the young must come first. The sick must also be considered. And only what is left shall be divided equally among all the rest. No one shall have more than another. No one shall have less than another." This was the law of the tribe. Now, this type of law, of course, would be a little difficult for us to understand, perhaps, but there is something in it that seems to belong strangely to America, and perhaps has something we could learn from these elders that went before. Now, along the Atlantic seaboard, there was the most highly evolved group of Indians, probably, on the North American continent. And they formed together the Great League of the Iroquois, the Iroquois of the Six Nations and of the Seven, the Great League of Peace. And this league consisted of what was called the Long House. And it said in law, now here is your Indian, he couldn't read or write, but he said, "The earth is one long house. Everybody on it is one family. Everyone on it lives in the same house, which is the place we live, and everyone is responsible to keep the peace. This is final." Now, the house, the long house, was developed by an Indian mystic, Daganoweda. And he was, like the Jewish patriarch, slow of speech. And he found another Indian who was later to become the Hiawatha of Longfellow's poem, who was to be his spokesman. And he was the one who carried the doctrine of the long house to the people of the Six Nations, later Seven Nations. And the long house was where they spread the white cloth of the peace. And it was a kind of Congress or Senate. Each tribe or division of the house, of the long house, each had its own representative called a sachem. We would call them a senator. They were the lawmakers, and they gathered at regular times to make the laws of the tribe. And it's interesting to note that the women of the tribe did not attend these meetings and did not participate in the legislative procedure, but they, and they alone, voted for and selected the senators. No one could occupy a position of authority in the Great League unless he was elected by women. The second thing that is interesting about this particular point, certainly, and one that needs perhaps more consideration than we've given it, and that is that the women of the tribe also implied and demanded a certain rule of the League of the Nations. That is, no senator could vote for anything relating to his own tribe. Every one of the senators could vote on everyone's tribe except his own, because it decided that there should be no way in which he could vote a special advantage to his own people. This is something that, might sometime have a thought for the future. You don't know. It has a point or two. Now, when the sachems met in tribal congress, the time came for the great meeting. The word was spoken. The door is open. The door is open meant that everyone could have his say. But, however, there must never be any unkind language. Never should one candidate or one senator rebuke another. No one should tell what was wrong with the other. He should tell what was right with what he thought was necessary. He should not say, I'm wiser, I am brighter, I am better informed than the others. He should say, this is what I propose. Everyone can have their own say. And when it was all finished and it was decided what was going to happen, then the door was closed again, and these senators went back to their normal tribal responsibilities. A group of these were sent to England at one time in the early days, while the tribe of the League of Nations was still very powerful, and presented at court, and they made a tremendous impression. They arrived in full feathers, with all their bearskins and their moccasins and their beadwork, and the reports of the English government at that time said that they were the most solemnly honorable people they had ever seen. That they were there for a purpose, and they did the purpose for which they were appointed. Now the tribe went along and gradually involved some other members and was gradually becoming a very powerful instrument. It still exists in certain parts of Canada as a tribal rule or a tribal law of procedure. One of the most interesting points, perhaps, in connection with this was the relationship between the Great League and William Penn. Now, William Penn was one of the white people whom the Indians learned to really like. And they admired him on the ground that they knew he would never break his word, that he always kept his promise, and he was always fair to them. When Penn came to the United States, he brought with him a grant of land from the King of England. The King of England charged Penn's family and those settlers that went with him a very tidy sum for this grant. So when he left, he told the king, he had an audience with the king, told the king he was going to make arrangements to purchase this land from the Indians. And the king said, but you've already bought it from me, and I think you paid a pretty good price for it. And Penn said, I'm sorry, sire. I can't take it that way, because you had no right to sell it to me. It belonged to the Indians, and I'm paying them for it. This is what they liked about him among the Indians. Also, the tribe developed what was called the Peace Belt, possibly the first passport that we know of. The peace belt was made either of shell wampum or bead wampum. And the great peace belt of Penn is in exhibition until Philadelphia now. But this peace belt enabled a member of the tribes to travel anywhere among all most distant and warlike peoples. And if he carried the peace belt, he was absolutely safe. No one would do anything to injure him. Because one of the things these people did have that was very important was they had a certain integrity of spirit that was not easily affected by changing circumstances. All of which now brings us to one of the keynote situations of the whole matter. What is the way in which we can best define the way of the Indian religion? First of all, we must assume that it is a natural religion, a religion that comes from observation and reflection and not from indoctrination. The Indian lives close to nature, and like most primitive people, even now, the Indians had a very deep, mysterious communion with the earth. They came so close to it, dependency upon it, that they gained a great respect for nature. They respected all life, every living thing. They respected and believed in life, and they believed that all creatures, great and small, had souls just as much as they had. That everything was alive, everything was divine in its substance and essence, and regardless of circumstances, must always be treated with respect and decency. That we learn mostly by quietly contemplating the realities of life. In the Southwest, there's no doubt in the world that the sand paintings and the great chants of the Abhichai are mandalas, that they are meditation symbols. They were created especially for a purpose, most of them, and that purpose was healing. But the actual symbol itself, if you go to one reservation today and one of the surviving medicine priests makes a sand painting, and you go to another reservation 200 miles away and have another painter do the same subject, these men have never met each other. They've had no contact of any kind, but there will not be the slightest difference between the two pictures. These pictures come down from a traditional background. They are carried in the mind for ages. They are part of the orenda. They are part of the way in which the Indian, not having a written language, makes pictures of the realities of his own existence. Pictures for the contemplation of life. These pictures have meanings for others, but a special meaning for himself. For he's actually drawing a picture of his own inner life, of the part of himself which belongs to the great world around and above.